Good evening and welcome to Miracle Distribution Center. Tonight we're going to be sponsoring a lecture by Dr. Roger Walsh. Dr. Roger Walsh is a physician, professor of psychiatry and philosophy at the University of California at Irvine. He also has a PhD in psychology. He has published the books Beyond Ego, Transpersonal Dimensions in Psychology, Beyond Health and Normality, Explorations of Exceptional Psychological Well-Being, Staying Alive, The Psychology of Human Survival, and will soon publish The Spirit of Shamanism. He has been a student of A Course in Miracles for 11 years, and together with his wife, Frances Vaughn, has edited three collections of quotations from the Course, Accept This Gift, A Gift of Peace, and A Gift of Healing. Without further ado, I would like you to welcome with me Dr. Roger Walsh.
Thank you, Beverly, and thank you all. There's a general principle of public speaking that one should never, never, never begin with an apology. So let me do that by saying that I have managed to catch one of the bugs going around, and I have this bad throat. And this is just to let you know that there will be much stopping for drinking and chewing of tablets and assorted things during the evening. This is all terribly embarrassing since, one, I'm a physician, I'm meant to be able to cure these things. And secondly, I'm talking about A Course in Miracles, which says sickness is a defense against the truth. And personally, I always thought that was nonsense until when I was going through the course, my first time through the lessons, I went and sat a three-month meditation retreat. About halfway through that retreat, I started getting these intense stomach cramps and couldn't eat much and vomited a bit. And I thought I'd got an ulcer from the stress of meditation. And when I finally got out of the retreat, I went and had myself x-rayed and bariumed and all the other obnoxious things they do to you to look at stomachs, and they came up with nothing. And gradually the symptoms went away, and 9 months later I went back into retreat. The first morning of my retreat, I opened up my Course in Miracles lesson, and lo and behold, it's sickness is a defense against the truth. But that's ridiculous. I don't believe that. And I threw the book on the bed. Within 1 minute, I had a full-blown abdominal attack. I said, all right, I get it, I surrender. I picked up the book, I read it through, and it disappeared like that. The lessons sometimes are very clear and very hard to deny. So I don't deny that this is a defense against the truth, but I still have a sore throat. So the Course says that before we begin anything, we should ask, what is it for? So since we have this wonderful opportunity of being together for an evening, it seems appropriate for us to ask, what is this for? And perhaps you'd just like to take a moment to be quiet and look within and see what you would like this evening to be for. And for myself, I would like it to be for our mutual healing and awakening, and for our mutual empowerment of each other as effective, more effective agents of healing and help in the world, so that from us can radiate help and healing into this world which so sorely needs it. What better way to begin than to read something from the Course, which I think speaks to a nice way of beginning. Let us be still an instant and forget all things we ever learned, all thoughts we had, and every preconception that we hold of what things mean and what their purpose is. Let us remember not our own ideas of what the world is for. We do not know. Let every image held of everyone be loosened from our minds and swept away. Be innocent of judgment, unaware of any thoughts of evil or of good that ever crossed your mind of anyone. Now do you know him not, but you are free to learn of him and learn of him anew. It's really a wonderful opportunity just to be together, to share the course. And for me, it's a wonderful opportunity to have this chance to speak to you about it. Because for a long time, when I was studying this material, I resisted speaking on it or doing any teaching whatsoever, because I had the rather curious idea, exactly opposite to what the course said, that first I should get myself together, I should get myself enlightened, and then I should go out and teach. And there were two things which convinced me this might be an erroneous position. One was the course continuously saying that first you can't not teach. And the second was that my wife, Frances Vaughan, pointed out that judging from my rate of progress so far, there was an excellent chance I'd be dead before I ever got round to it. So, here I am. And what I'd like to do this evening is to explore with you the commonalities that the Course shares with the great spiritual traditions, espousing a position that if we look at the world's great religious traditions, we find at their core, their mystical core, a common body of wisdom, of psychology, of philosophy, of techniques for helping us to train our minds and realize our true nature. And this has become known as the perennial philosophy, the perennial wisdom, the perennial psychology. And what I want to suggest is that the Course is an embodiment of this perennial wisdom dressed in a language and thought system appropriate for our time. And of course, it also has some unique features. So let's then look together at the commonalities and the unique features of the Course in Miracles vis-a-vis this millennia-old worldwide tradition of the greatest depths and heights of human wisdom. Now, I need to make clear, this is just my understanding of the way the things are of the perennial philosophy. I make no guarantees that I'll hold the same positions next year or even next week. This is my current understanding, my current attempt to try and put this together. Now, before we start exploring the commonalities of the Course, we have to acknowledge that there are enormous differences between the world's religions and spiritual traditions. In fact, considering that they lay claim to special claim to truth, it's amazing how little agreement they have as to what that truth is. And you can find almost any position on any subject in some tradition or other. In some religions, there is a God. In others, such as Buddhism or Taoism, there's either no God or it's he or she or it is irrelevant. In some theistic traditions, God is a male, in others a woman, in others an it or a them. Again, no agreement. In some, God is loving, in others terrifying. Humans are insignificant pawns or the children of God. The physical universe is all there is, or it's a mere illusion, a figment of our imagination to be let go, released, so that we can awaken to a larger reality. And there's no more agreement, in many cases, on how we should relate to God or this larger reality, or how we should conduct ourselves in order to awaken to it. In some perspectives, in many traditions, there's the idea that we are responsible, that our choices make a difference. In others, such as Calvinism, there's the idea of predestination, the elect have been chosen. In one of the ancient traditions, the Ajarikas, 2,500 years ago, you were up for 84,000 reincarnations. You didn't get off any earlier if you were good. You didn't get off any later if you were bad. That was it. So, yeah, should you marry? Should you be celibate? Should you be in the world? Should you withdraw from it? You can find any position. Yet among all these diverse positions, one can find some commonalities. And so what I'd like to do now is just explore what the great religions, particularly the mystical core, the perennial wisdom at the heart of these traditions, says about certain perspectives. And before we can do that, of course, we need to decide, well, what are the great religions? And obviously, this one can take various perspectives here, but one way, and it's a very simplistic way, but it's useful, is just to look at the numbers. And this doesn't tell the whole story, but if we take the four major world religions, Christianity, which has 32% of the world's population, Islam, which has 19%, Hinduism, which has 14%, and Buddhism, which has 6%, we have accounted for 2/3 of the world's population and 80% of the religious practitioners. There are about 20% who call themselves atheist, agnostic. So with these four traditions, we've covered about at least 2/3 of the world's population, and most people would agree that these certainly are great traditions which have lasted thousands of years, which have embodied and carried human wisdom throughout centuries and across cultures. But even here, of course, there are enormous differences. But here I'll be focusing on the similarities. We just need to keep in mind that, of course, whatever we find in the way of similarity, we can also point to some differences. Now, within these similarities, there are four general areas that I think are valuable for us to consider in terms of situating the course within this tradition, sometimes called the great tradition, which is the sum total of the religious, spiritual, philosophical wisdom of humankind. So we're going to attempt to situate the course within this great tradition. And then what do we want to look at? What areas? Well, I want to suggest there are four key areas that would be really valuable for us to explore. One is how great religious teachings are revealed to us. The second is what the different traditions say about the human condition, our condition. Third, what they say about our potential. And finally, what they say about the means for realizing our potential. So, first area then, how are religious teachings revealed? How do we come to have these great spiritual traditions and wisdom? And how's the course fit in with this? Well, as I'm sure most of you know, the course was received by Helen Schuckman, a psychologist at Columbia Medical School, by a process of inner dictation, much to her enormous distress, not to mention embarrassment. And this was before channeling was in vogue, but you know, one could certainly call this channeling. And I don't know about you, but I feel terribly embarrassed to be associated with something which was channeled. And I'm not alone in that, because Bill Thetford, Helen Schuckman, were incredibly embarrassed about this, and they carefully hid the manuscript in their office safe for several years, as Bill said, hoping someone would find it when I died. And it was, as he said, their guilty secret. But actually, it's very interesting, you know. As far as I can see, religions have usually been produced from very unrespectable sources. Yeah. Jesus was condemned as a common criminal. Lao Tzu wandered off into the desert as a total unknown. Confucius could never get a job. Muhammad was this camel driver who was very suspect and a lot of people waged war on. I mean, hardly promising material. Now, I would have felt wonderful if the course had come from some universally acknowledged great enlightened being, but that doesn't seem to be the way the game works. And in this case, with the course coming through by this process of inner dictation, it's very interesting because if you start looking at channeling, you get it's very, very interesting and much misunderstood. And in point of fact, if you start looking around, there is an enormous amount of nonsense in channel material. And if that was all there was, it would be all very simple and we could just dismiss it. The problem is that there's also some good stuff. It's much rarer, but there's also some very, very profound stuff. And some stuff which really defies common sense explanation, and it's both secular and religious. To give a secular example, there was a St. Louis housewife in 1920 called Pearl Curran. And Pearl was pretty uneducated, had no background in writing whatsoever, but suddenly started dictating materials, poems, books from, depending on your belief system, some deeper part of a mind, or Patience Worth, who claimed to be some being from somewhere. And Pearl Curran, who'd never written anything in her life, suddenly started to be able to do some interesting things, such as, if you gave her a topic, she would be able to write a poem, dictate a poem as fast as anyone could take it down in shorthand. She could also do interesting things, like if you said, I would like you to write two poems, one on this, one on that, and alternate, as you dictate it, write the alternate lines from each poem. Or she could also say, I'd like you to write a poem with each line of the poem starting with a successive letter of the alphabet. So the first line would begin with a letter with a word beginning with A, and the second with a word beginning with B, and so forth. As various poets who examined the process said, this is utterly impossible. She also wrote some award-winning books and was very favorably reviewed in the New York Times. You know, well, it makes no sense to me. Now, when we start looking at the religious material, it's also very interesting. It seems pretty clear that some of the Old Testament was produced in this way. Seems also clear that part of the Quran was produced in this way. In Judaism, so there have been scores of Jewish mystics who produced works by this process of inner dictation. In Buddhism, many Indian and Tibetan texts were produced by this. And perhaps the best-known example in the West is the Greek oracle Delphi, who is a very interesting series of character. Actually, there were a series of priestesses. The priestess would supposedly speak on behalf of the god Apollo. And the oracle Delphi gave a number of interesting bits of information. It was the oracle who called Socrates the wisest man in Greece, much to Socrates' surprise. Also gave interesting advice on a number of things. For example, in addition to a lot of trivial advice, gave information, for example, when the Etruscans fleet was invading, the people approached the oracle for advice and on how to manage how to defend against the fleet, and the oracle's advice was use as few ships as possible. Not exactly standard military naval advice. And I must say I'm most impressed by the people's faith that they sent out a mere 5 ships against the entire Etruscan navy. And the Etruscan navy, not wanting to look bad, also sent out only 5 ships, which were promptly sunk. So the Etruscans sent out another 5, which were also sunk. And after 4 lots of 5 ships had been sunk, the Etruscan navy retired from the scene. Now, this is recorded history. I mean, this is... Yeah. The oracle was also approached by King Croesus. Croesus is, you know, rich as Croesus, one of the wealthiest men in the ancient world. And Croesus was interested in becoming even more wealthy. So he asked for advice about invading his neighbors. And the oracle gave the very sage advice, if you cross the river Halys, which was the adjacent river, you will destroy a great empire. So Croesus, much inspired, crossed the river and did destroy a great empire, his own. It was a pretty smart oracle. And smart enough to stay in business for 900 years and to change the course of human history. So this phenomenon of, you know, inner dictation, whatever you want to call it, seems to have been very common in the world religions, to be a source of continued inspiration and refreshment and re-inspiration of traditions, and also to have quite literally changed the course of human history on many occasions. So here is an interesting comparison about the way the course appeared, which I assumed was this more or less unique event, and... But when we start looking at different traditions, we find it's by no means unique. Now, I need to say again that most of the stuff that comes through in this way is pretty nonsensical. And I found nothing on par with the course anywhere. But it is also clear that occasionally very profound stuff comes through by this process. So the course certainly fits with many sources of the perennial wisdom in diverse traditions. Okay, so that's the first of the 4 areas we're going to examine in terms of the commonality between the course and the different traditions at the heart of the perennial wisdom. Second was the nature of the human condition. Perhaps the most common feature of the world's major spiritual traditions is that they find great fault with the human condition as it is. They make very clear that things aren't good, that there's an enormous amount of suffering within us all and within the world. They point to the sorrows and the shortness of life, the inevitability of sickness, old age, death, the ever-present confrontation with meaning, with purpose, with questions of relationship, of aloneness, the uncertainty and fickleness of fate. Wonderful quotes from the Psalms. In the immensity of the universe, we seem as dust. Our lives are but toil and trouble. They are soon gone. They come to an end like a sigh, like a dream. What person can live and not see death? This is from Judaism, our Judeo-Christian tradition. In Hinduism, Buddhism, there are the sorrows of samsara. There's the Buddha's first noble truth, that the unenlightened life has suffering as an inherent part of it. And the Course in Miracles, of course, agrees completely. It says, this is an insane world, a world of sorrow and death, and this world is not where you belong. Well, if we don't belong here, why are we here? Well, the great traditions and the Course say that it's because of the state of our minds. That our minds are out of control. And if the great traditions find fault with our condition as it is, they find even more fault with the state of our minds. They say our minds are driven and dominated by unhealthy desires and fears, obsessed with sensations, with physical objects, with pleasures, with getting more, getting variations and intensities of touch and feeling. And their lives are spent in sacrifice for variations and intensification of touch, of feeling, of sound, of hearing, of sight, for sensory pleasures of one type or another, which distracts us from the inner world, from the truth within, and leaves us to be dominated by egocentric motives. Our lives are then said to be driven by the twin powers of addiction, trying to get, an aversion, trying to push away. And from these spring a range of unhealthy motives, greed, fear, anger, hatred, jealousy, which lead to such things as the deadly sins of Christianity, or the hindrances of Buddhism, or the pain-bearing obstructions of yoga. Different names for similar afflictions. Of course, the Course's message is identical. Our usual mind state is said to be out of control, and in lesson 236 it says, I have a kingdom I must rule. At times it does not seem I am its king at all. It seems to triumph over me and tell me what to think and say and do. Think and what to do and feel. So the Course's message, like the great traditions, is that our minds are out of control. So the Course and the great religions would agree very strongly with the great poet Milton, that the mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. Or with Edmund Spencer, it is the mind that maketh good or ill, that maketh wretch or happy, rich or poor. And it's very interesting that the first lines of the Buddha's teachings in the Dhammapada, the first three lines are, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make our world. As a matter of fact, one can summarize the Course in terms of our thoughts and thought system. Now, any time you start summarizing something as profound and rich and multidimensional as the Course, you're going to do it grave injustice. And I personally have found the Course to be this wonderful Rorschach test. And you look into it and you see yourself. And everyone has their own particular perspective on what the Course really is. And you're very fortunate this evening to have one of the very few people who can tell you what it really is. So what the Course really is and what it's really saying is this. It says, among many other things, that your thought system creates your state of mind and your perception of yourself and the world. Fair enough. Same thing as the Buddha. Same thing as lots of other people. Your thought system is insane. You're insane. In fact, you're so insane you don't even know you're insane. You are suffering from a shared, unhappy, psychotic dream. If you'd like to get out of this, here's an alternate thought system which you can substitute for yours. And this thought system, the courses, will get rid of your unhappy psychotic dream and substitute a happy dream. Still a dream, but it says the dream from which it's easiest to awaken. So, now, this point about dreaming is actually very profound and very important, because a lot of what the Course says and a lot of the deeper meaning hidden in the world's spiritual traditions doesn't make sense unless you really begin to get the implications of this message that we are dreaming, that what we take to be a fully waking state is actually a dream. And the Course makes clear, wonderfully clear, that the best demonstration of the fact that we may be dreaming right now is our sleeping dream. You know, every night we go to sleep and we prove to ourselves that we can literally create universes. Every night we go to sleep and we create worlds. And at the time they seem totally real. And you're in there and the walls seem solid and the body feels real and other people seem to be there and you interact with them and all these emotions come up and it's terribly dramatic and exciting and fearful. You know? And you think if this body gets annihilated, that's the end of you. And all the time you're lying in bed happily asleep. Now, we can get some sense of this, our true nature, if we look at the opposite of the unenlightened condition as it usually is. So in place of, so we can get some sense by looking at the opposite. So instead of finitude and limits, we find descriptions of infinity and unbounded being. In place of time and change, we find descriptions of the eternal and changeless. In place of birth and death, we have the unborn and deathless. And in place of angst and fear, we have love and bliss and joy. And in the descriptions of the mind, likewise, the enlightened mind is said to be freed from the ravages of fear and greed and hatred and anger. It's said to be at peace. And this peace ultimately deepens into in the words of Jesus, the peace which passeth all human understanding, or in the words of the Buddha, into nirvana, the highest form of happiness. Or if for the yogi, it is the yogi finally rests in the peace and bliss of samadhi. As the Course says, a quiet mind is not a little gift. The message that's clear here is that to the extent we quiet the raucous activity of our untrained minds, to that extent we find beneath that activity a place of boundless peace and boundless being and boundless bliss. We also find our true self. We find our identity. Our personal egoic identity gradually dissolves, we're told, into this transpersonal identity, into a being which is beyond categories, beyond words, beyond thought. We find descriptions here of Hinduism's Atman or Satchitananda, boundless being, consciousness, bliss. Or Zen's one mind, or the Christ consciousness, or pure spirit, or Geist, all these words pointing towards something which cannot be spoken of, us. And the Course says, no one's experience can compare, even in the slightest, with the glorious surprise of remembering who he is. And the Course describes the difference between the limited ego and this infinite self in the wonderful words from the Little Garden, saying, this fragment of your mind, the ego, is such a tiny part of the mind that, could you but appreciate the whole, you would see instantly that it is like the smallest sunbeam to the sun, or like the faintest ripple on the surface of the ocean. In its amazing arrogance, this tiny sunbeam, the ego, has decided it is the sun. This almost imperceptible ripple hails itself as the ocean. Think how alone and frightened is this little thought, this infinitesimal illusion holding itself apart against the universe. Do not accept this little fenced-off aspect as yourself. The sun and ocean are as nothing beside what you are. The sunbeam sparkles only in the sunlight, and the ripple dances as it rests upon the ocean. Yet in neither sun nor ocean is the power that rests in you. So, the description in the Course and these other traditions is that eventually the self, other boundaries dissolve, and our sense of identity dissolves into this larger, actually boundless being. And this is the Buddhist recognition of anatta, the fact, the recognition that the ego was an illusion all along. It's the goal of yoga. Yoga means union, the union of the self, little s, with the self, big s. It's Taoism's alignment with the Tao. And for the Christian mystic, it's deification, the oneness with God. And in the Course's words, let me remember I am one with God. I am one with all my brothers and myself in everlasting holiness and peace. Nice stuff. The question is, how do we do it? Well, what I want to suggest is that authentic spiritual traditions embody a technology for training the mind so as to open us to these dimensions of being. They contain effectively a technology of transcendence. Now, we have to be careful here because there's been a centuries-long debate, particularly in Christianity but also in other traditions, between the what's sometimes been called the debate between good faith and good works. Do we awaken or are we saved by virtue of our faith or by our own activities? And this paradox is suggested wonderfully by an Islamic saying which says, practice will not make you realize God, but you won't realize God without practice. And the Course seems to resolve this paradox by saying that the initial steps are up to us, helped very much by the Holy Spirit, but the final step is God's. So our task is the little willingness of opening ourselves to the readying process so that the final step can be taken by God. So, what are the core components? What are the common elements of this technology, of these techniques for awakening? Well, I want to suggest that if we look across the authentic spiritual traditions, and by authentic I mean capable of assisting people to realize their true nature, if we look across the great traditions, we find five common elements in all authentic spiritual traditions, including the Course. And these are ethical training, training attention, emotional transformation, changing motivation, and the cultivation of wisdom. Let's take a look at those. Ethical training, attentional training, emotional transformation, changing motivation, and the cultivation of wisdom. Ethical training. Very different perspective here in these traditions from the way we usually think of ethical training. In common thinking about religious morality, there's a lot of guilt-based, do this or God will get you. But this is not the perspective of the perennial wisdom. The perennial wisdom views ethics as a means for training the mind. And it views ethics as a means of training the mind for the reason that if we look closely, we find that unethical behavior both stems from and reinforces painful mind states such as greed, fear, anger, hatred, jealousy, etc. Mind states which are destructive to others and ourselves. And on the other hand, ethical behavior tends to not reinforce these mind states and hence to reduce and extinguish them, and to cultivate their opposites, to cultivate mind states of generosity, of love, of joy, etc. So that ethicality then is seen in these traditions as a skillful technique for training the mind to reduce the hindrances or barriers or blocks that keep us locked in our egocentric ways of being, and of freeing ourselves from these to be moved by other more healthy, helpful motives. So that one becomes ethical from an understanding of these traditions, not out of fear or guilt, but simply because one recognizes this is what leads to greater well-being from oneself and others. So that ethics here is recognized as a skillful strategy. So, that's the first of our five common elements of training or technology of transcendence in the different traditions. So, first, ethics. Second, attentional training. How many people here are meditators? How many people have meditated? About half, okay. I don't need to tell you, our minds are a mess. You sit down, you decide you'll follow the breath, and 20 minutes later you wake up and realize, you know, that, yeah, there was breathing going on, but you weren't around for it. Around the turn of the century, William James, perhaps the greatest American philosopher, said very precisely, voluntary attention cannot be continuously sustained. And Western psychology has pretty much bought that ever since. And it's an old idea. The Bhagavad Gita, the so-called Hindu Bible, says, restless man's mind is so strongly shaken in the grip of the senses, gross and grown hard with stubborn desire for what is worldly. How shall we tame it? Truly, I think, the wind is no wilder. Sounds familiar to you meditators, I'm sure. And the Course says, you are far too tolerant of mind wandering. No? Because it costs us enormous amount. For starters, we're not around most of the time. We're driving down the freeway and we're off, repeating the argument we had this morning and planning next week. And I mean, we're very rarely around. You know? We have no control of this. Now, what one of the most amazing things I've ever recognized in this life was to realize the extent to which our minds are outside our voluntary control, and the fact we can go an entire life without recognizing that. That's pretty amazing. Now, if you add a few other elements in there, such as the fact that our minds are the source of all pleasure and suffering, okay, and then you add the fact that the mind's totally out of control, bad recipe, you know. So you can begin to realize, I mean, it doesn't take all that many brains to realize why, as Ramana Maharshi said, all scriptures, without any exception, proclaim that for attaining salvation, mind should be subdued. If the mind's a source of all pleasure and suffering, and it's out of control, it'd be real smart to bring it under control. It sounds simple. Well, in point of fact, what we require is to be able to direct our attention as we want. To be able to hold it here, to be able to not wander off into fantasies or get lost in dreams as we usually are, but to gather the full power of our mind under voluntary control so as to be directed wherever we want, to be able to cultivate whatever emotions we want, love or compassion, instead of, if we're angry or upset, being totally lost in that and just reinforcing and building it. And the great spiritual traditions for millennia have devised techniques for training attention. The earliest religion of which we have record, shamanism, probably goes back at least 50,000 years, maybe a couple of 100,000 years. It clearly has practices for training attention. And it's a wonderful story of the way these people do this. And a nice story of one of the Eskimo shamans, Igshukshuk, around the turn of the century, described his own training. He said he was taken in the middle of winter, this is in the Arctic, to this little snow hut, which was so small he couldn't stand up. He was left there for 30 days and had one instruction: think only of the Great Spirit. And about 1 week into this practice, he was brought a little piece of meat. And then another couple of weeks later, he's brought another little piece of meat. So he's basically fasting for a month in the middle of winter in a snow hut by himself, trying to think only of the Great Spirit. that's a pretty tough road. You know, myself, I like the course which says no course could ask less of you than this one. That's more my style. Now, but whatever the path, the method is the same. It's a continuous bringing back of attention to a predetermined object. The yogi returns again and again to the breath. The course asks us to come back to our thought for the day, or our image, or our exercise, whatever it is. We're constantly recollecting the mind, bringing it back to what we've decided to focus on, and not letting it wander off. So we're no longer guilty of what the... bad word, guilty. We're no longer liable to what the course says of being too tolerant of mind wandering. We're reducing our mind wandering. The common element is this repeated recalling of attention, so that we're breaking this conditioned, continuous, fickle wanderlust of the mind as it goes all over the place without even our knowledge. And what results is that our mind becomes under our control rather than us being under the control of our mind. And this gives power. In fact, it gives an extraordinary power. In Buddhism, there are four so-called imponderables, things which are said to be so profound, so complex, that you can't fathom them. If you think about them too much, you're at risk of going crazy. One of them is origination, how the universe began. Second is causation or karma, how things are caused. The third is the scope of the mind of a Buddha. And the fourth is the power of a fully concentrated mind. So apparently a fully concentrated mind has awesome power at its disposal. Now, in the Eastern spiritual traditions, the metaphor that's used to illustrate the power and perspicacity and usefulness of a trained attention, a quiet mind, is the metaphor of the lake. And if we look at a lake, when there's a wind blowing, what we see are all these ripples. And if we want to pay some attention, we can see the patterns of the ripples and the direction they're heading and learn a lot about them. That's very useful if you're going to be swimming in the water. But if the wind is stilled and the lake comes to stillness, then we can now see down into the bottom of the lake. We can see into the depths of the lake mind. And we can also see something else. Formerly, when we looked at the surface of the lake, what we saw were these myriad unconnected reflections, constantly changing, unconnected, no pattern, no relationship. Now what we see is a reflection of the world around us, unified, whole, meaningful. So the message is that when our minds, the lake mind, is quietened, then we can perceive into its depths the source of our being and of the meaning and patterns, and we can see the interconnected wholeness of all things. So these are said to be the benefits of training attention. So, first two elements of mind training, ethical training, attentional training. Thirdly, emotional transformation. Here there are two components. One is reducing unskillful emotions, and the second is cultivating positive ones. Reducing negative emotions such as anger, fear, jealousy, greed, etc. These are all based on addiction and aversion. Addiction. How do we work with this? Carlos Castaneda, nice quote, "The power to reduce our wants is all we have to oppose the forces of our lives. Without it, we are dust in the wind." Oscar Wilde said it very nicely. There are two tragedies in life. One is not to get what you want. One is not to get your heart's desire. The other is to get it. Now, the Course has a variety of ideas and practices to reduce our attachment or craving to what it calls idols. These are things we crave. And it gives us a whole series of lessons. Wonderful one, lesson 128, "The world I see holds nothing that I want. The world you see holds nothing that you need to offer you, nothing you can use in any way, nor anything at all that serves to give you joy. Believe this thought and you are saved from years of misery, from countless disappointments and from hopes that turn to bitter ashes of despair. No one but must accept this thought as true if he would leave the world behind and soar beyond its petty scope a little ways. Not that the world, not that we can't live in joy and love in the world, the Course and these traditions make very clear that we can, but as long as we think that any thing in the world will make us happy, we're destined to unhappiness. So, reducing addiction as the first component of reducing unskillful emotions. Second is working to reduce aversion. And aversion being the root of such things as anger and hatred and so forth. The Buddhists have a very nice description of way of looking at anger. They say, anger should be regarded like stale urine mixed with poison. Not big on anger, the Buddhists. The Course says, anger is never justified. Attack has no foundation. And the Course's primary tool for working with reducing and ultimately extinguishing anger is forgiveness. And the Course provides an exquisitely detailed, sophisticated variety of techniques for reducing anger and for forgiving. In fact, it provides a far more extensive and sophisticated range of techniques and description of an understanding of forgiveness as a tool than any other path I have found. In fact, it says in a wonderful, wonderful lesson, page 122, forgiveness offers everything I want. What could you want? Forgiveness cannot give. Do you want peace? Forgiveness offers it. Do you want happiness, a quiet mind, a certainty of purpose and a sense of worth and beauty that transcends the world? Do you want care and safety and the warmth of sure protection always? Do you want a quietness that cannot be disturbed, a gentleness that never can be hurt, a deep abiding comfort and a rest so perfect it can never be upset? All this forgiveness offers you and more. Nice promise. So, transforming emotions, the third technique among the in the technology of transcendence. Reducing unskillful emotions as the first part of that. Second part is cultivating positive emotions. Cultivating what the traditions describe as boundless joy, boundless bliss, unlimited love, compassion. These are what in Buddhism are called the divine abodes, that is, states of such unlimited, boundless love and compassion and sympathetic joy that they feel divine. In Christianity, it's agape. In bhakti tradition, it's the divine love. And the Course has numerous ideas and lessons aimed at this. God's will for me is perfect happiness. I share God's will for happiness for me. I feel the love of God within me now. Numerous lessons here aimed at the cultivation of these positive, boundless emotions. So, those first three components, ethical training, attentional training, transforming emotions. Fourth part of this technology of transcendence is motivation, shifting motivation. The perennial philosophy, these spiritual traditions, encourage a number of shifts in motivation to reduce compulsive addiction and acquisition, focusing our desires from scattered wanting everything to focusing on what's most important, shifting our motivation from getting stuff outside us to recognizing the source of satisfaction is within. And changing our fundamental orientation from getting towards giving. Traditionally, this has been called purification. Psychologists would recognize it as moving up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And for the philosopher Kierkegaard, it was epitomized in the saying, purity of heart is to will one thing. Alternatively, in the words of Jesus, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and all else will be given unto you, i.e., in psychological terms, seek for seek self-transcendence first, and all the other motives will be fulfilled. The Course says the same thing. Now, what then is the highest motivation? If we're going to focus our motives, if we're going to reduce our scattered wants, if we're going to focus our desire, what would be the highest desire to focus on? Well, Buddhism provides an interesting model here. In Mahayana Buddhism, the great vehicle of Buddhism, there is the ideal of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva, Bodhi means awakening, Bodhisattva means awakening being. An awakening being has two motives. To awaken self with the aim of using that awakening for the awakening and healing and helping of all beings. So it's not awakening merely for oneself, but awakening for the larger purpose of awakening all beings. And this just may be the highest ideal the human mind has ever conceived. And for the Buddhists, this is not just one lifetime, this is over as many lifetimes as it takes to liberate all sentient beings. And this is the game of games for these people. Now, it's very interesting that the Course is also a bodhisattvic path. The Course makes very clear, none of us are going to get out of this game until all of us get out of it. And you can't work for yourself alone because you're not alone. You can't try to clean up your mind only because all minds are one and interconnected. You can't try to satisfy yourself only because the self you're trying to satisfy doesn't exist. So, it makes clear that to truly awaken, we must seek to awaken and serve all beings. But it also makes clear this is in no way a sacrifice. That, as Lesson 126 says, all that I give is given to myself. That devotion to a brother cannot hold you back. That to seek our true nature within ourselves alone would be a tragic mistake, because it's not in ourselves alone. Yeah. To seek for a personal goal would be directly counter to the whole purpose of the process, because there is no person, single individual person. There's only us, one child of God. And it also makes clear that eventually all of us are going to be engaged in this goal. The teachers of God are merely those who've chosen earlier than others. And it may be, just as has so often been said, that there are indeed only two types of people in the world, bodhisattvas and those who have not yet recognized their bodhisattvas. So this is the shift in motivation that the Course talks about. Finally, wisdom. There are two levels of wisdom here that are important, initial wisdom and final wisdom. The initial wisdom is the wisdom that starts one on the path, that starts one reading the Course or practicing meditation or whatever, that sees the suffering and unsatisfactoriness in the world and thinks there must be a better way. And this is how the Course came into being. The Course arrived when Bill Thetford, in disgust with the way his and Helen's lives were working in the university there and how unsatisfactory it was and how much fighting was going on, said, there must be a better way and I'm determined to find it. And the Course came very shortly thereafter. This initial wisdom recognizes the extent and inevitability of suffering in unenlightened, unspiritual living. It's the recognition of dukkha, the Buddha's first noble truth. And spiritual traditions classically contain teachings to help us recognize this, to recognize that the unenlightened living does lead to suffering. But this isn't the final wisdom. There are levels of wisdom. The final wisdom is a profound insight into the nature of mind, of self, of reality. This is a direct transcendental intuition, not thinking about, not intellectual, but a direct seeing beyond words, beyond thoughts, beyond description, transverbal, transrational. This is what's been known as prajna in the East, transcendental wisdom, gnosis in the West, or similar to what the Course describes as knowledge. And the Course doesn't even try to describe what knowledge is, says you can't describe it, it's not describable. And this wisdom is liberating. because this wisdom is the recognition of our true nature. And that true nature is described in different words by different traditions, but the message is very much the same across them all. In Christianity, it's the kingdom of heaven is within you, or in the words of St. Clement, he who knows himself knows God. In Islam, in the words of Muhammad, it's he who knows himself knows his Lord. In the Upanishads, it's by understanding this self, all this universe is known. In Buddhism, look within, thou art the Buddha. In Hinduism, Atman, individual consciousness, and Brahman, the universal consciousness, are one. In Siddha Yoga, God dwells within you as you. And in the Course in Miracles, let me remember I am one with God. This is the final wisdom. This is the ultimate recognition that there is nothing but God, manifesting as and yet transcendent to all worlds, all beings, all levels of this universe. And the recognition that we've never been separate. The separation was an illusion. That as is said in the last lines of the text, and now we say amen, for Christ has come to dwell in the abode you set for him before time was, in calm eternity. The journey closes, ending at the place where it began. No trace of it remains. Not one illusion is accorded faith, and not one spot of darkness still remains to hide the face of Christ from anyone. Thy will is done, complete and perfectly, and all creation recognizes you and knows you as the only source it has. Clear in your likeness does the light shine forth from everything that lives and moves in you. For we have reached where all of us are one, and we are home where you would have us be. This is awakening, enlightenment, satori, moksha, wu, liberation, salvation. Different words, same realization. And the message of the Course and of all the different traditions of the great perennial philosophy can be summarized very simply in two words: wake up.